Okay, so this is Bio 241, and it is Thursday, September 25th, and let's talk about the test we've got coming up. So the test was supposed to be tonight, but it's not tonight. And I need at least two lectures to go over I need two nights to go over chapter 5. So that might be tonight a little bit and next time. So that means the 25th is gone and the 30th is gone. So I'm thinking of having the exam on October 2nd. That's a week from tonight. Okay. And that's going to be over chapters 4, 5, and 6 Thursday. But that means that you're going to have to study a lot over the weekend on chapter 5. Even though I'm only covered it about halfway, because it's sometimes it's difficult for students to just read chapter 5 and understand it well enough. Okay, so you got to study that chapter over the weekend. So do some of the review problems, read the textbook, look at the exam figures, just start trying to label those exam figures for chapter 5. All right, so we were talking about this slide right here that shows What's the enzyme that catalyzes this reaction right here? That interconverts carbonic acid with carbon dioxide. There's an enzyme, so we call this the something-something enzyme catalyzed reaction. It's the carbonic anhydrase reaction. Okay, so the enzyme is carbonic anhydrase. And it is freely reversible, so this reaction can go to the right or go to the left. And how do you know which direction it's going to go in?
Of that little arrow.
Yeah, well, because of the little arrow, but it's pointing in two directions. Okay, the way that you figure that out, all right, is by saying, well, if we say if this is in a place in your lungs where you're exhaling carbon dioxide, you're losing carbon dioxide, so this chemical is going away. Which way is that going to drive the equation? It's going to drive it to the left. So you're going to be releasing a lot of carbonic acid from your blood, converting it into CO2, and you're going to be breathing it out of your body. But in the tissues, for instance, that are producing CO2, right, they're putting a lot of CO2 in the blood. Which way is this equation going to run? So if we build up the concentration of CO2, which way is the reaction going to go? To the right or to the left?
Right.
To the right. That's right. So in your tissues, right, because they're producing CO2, it drives the equation. To the right, it produces carbonic acid. This is nice and soluble in the blood. So essentially carbon dioxide then gets transported in the blood as carbonic acid. And when it goes to the lungs, what happens? It gets converted back into CO2, comes out of solution, and you just breathe it out of your body.
So what is this called?
This is called the law of mass action, or Le Chatelier's principle. Some of you might know it by that principle right here. All right, so reactions where the delta G of the reactants is equal to the delta G of the products over here, this reaction freely can go backwards and forwards and is completely determined by the concentrations of the reactants and products. And we're going to see how that, well, I just gave you an example of how that affects our physiology, but many different effects. All right, a metabolic pathway is when we have some initial substrate for an enzyme-catalyzed reaction and it proceeds through a number of intermediate steps, all catalyzed by different enzymes into a final product. So you can see this is a multi-step enzymatic reaction. We call that a pathway. And so there, and all of these different letters right here, like B, C, D, E, these are what we call intermediates or components of the metabolic pathway. So to go from A to F, it's just not one enzymatically controlled reaction. What? It's a series of enzymatically controlled reactions. So that's what we mean by a metabolic pathway. And again, B, C, D, and E, these are all different chemicals. Those are all different chemicals.
That is a different series from metabolic pathway?
A metabolic pathway is what we see right here, starting at one initial substrate, ending up with a final product. But in order to go from A to F, it's just not one step. There are many intermediate steps that these molecules have to move through. And so that's a metabolic pathway. And each step is catalyzed by its own enzyme. So in this one right here, we have five different enzymes catalyzing five different steps, producing five different products. And the ones in the middle right here, these are what we call intermediates. It's only the end point of this metabolic pathway where we get the final product. So we'll give you some examples of this. One way that metabolic pathways are controlled is by end product inhibition. So here we see a metabolic pathway, right? So we have compounds A being turned into B, into C, into D, but right at C we see a branch point. Here, product C can either be converted into D or D prime. And if it gets converted into D prime, there's a different enzyme, and it's converted into E prime and finally F prime over here. But C can also be converted into D, E, and F by a different kind of pathway. So this is what we call a branch point. So C has two possible fates. What are the two possible fates for C? What can C become? Okay, C can become either D or D prime. And then if it rolls further along, of course, then you can get E prime or F prime or E or F, right? But C has the fate of either turning into D or F. C can't turn into E directly. Okay, it's got to go through this metabolic pathway, which would be a two-step process here. Not too long. All right, well, end product inhibition just means that when this final product, F prime, builds up inside the cell, so if you have a lot of F prime, you think you need to make more of it. As it's building up, your body doesn't need to make more and more of it because it's building up in concentration. And so what happens is that this product, right, since it's high concentration, will float around inside the cell, and it can actually bind to this enzyme, enzyme number 3. And when it binds to this enzyme, it turns it off. It turns the activity for that enzyme off. So C can't be converted into D prime. All right, now, is that such a bad thing? And D prime can't be converted into E prime, and E prime can't be converted into F prime because now this enzymatic step is blocked. But is that such a terrible thing? No. It's not terrible because you have enough of F prime in that particular cell to where, right, it would be a waste to actually make more. So it's beneficial to turn this pathway off. All right, but as C prime builds up inside the cell, then this alternative pathway opens up. And C can be converted into D, E, and F, right? And then this will build up the concentration of F, for instance. All right, in the meantime, then the concentration of F prime is decreasing, and then that might turn this enzymatic step back on, and it's going to fill F prime back up again. So it's always going to switch between these two different pathways, and the switching right here is determined by the concentration of this end product of that metabolic pathway. And so we call this allosteric inhibition, when F prime can affect an enzyme turning it off. That's allosteric inhibition. I have to get closer to my transmitter. Okay, and I'm not going to talk about inborn errors of metabolism, okay, as a specific example or this slide. I'm going to move right on to bioenergetics. And you've kind of covered this topic already in lab. All right, bioenergetics just refers to the flow of energy in living systems. And all living systems need some energy flow through them. All right, but what the heck does energy mean? Does anybody have sort of a working definition of energy? You might want to do a Google or go to Wikipedia sometime over the weekend and just kind of look up and see what energy means, because I'm talking about energy right here. But I'll tell you my understanding of it. Energy is just the ability to do work, right? Energy is, I guess it says right here, right? We call it free energy in terms of biochemical reactions. This is energy in an organized state. It can be used to do work. So any kind of energy is something that can be used to do work. So for instance, if you're very energetic in the morning, what do you have the ability to do? A lot of work that day. But if you don't have a lot of energy when you wake up, then chances are maybe you won't be able to do a lot of work that day. Right? So just think of energy as the ability to do work. And there are a couple laws of thermodynamics that describes the properties of energy and how they work with a biological system. The first law states that energy can neither be transformed, energy can't be created or destroyed. It can only be transformed from one kind of energy to another. All right, so energy will flow from one system to another, one molecule to another, but it can't ever be destroyed. So how can energy be converted? Can you think of any transformation reactions that convert one form of energy into another? Or let's just talk about different forms of energy. What is energy? What form does energy take? ATP. What kind of energy is ATP? That's what we call chemical energy. That's what we call chemical energy. So energy can be put into bonds between atoms. That's what we call chemical energy. And so, for instance, the energy in gasoline is a chemical energy as well. So what's another kind of energy? ATP is a good biochemical, so that's really kind of the same. ATP or biochemical is energy. Electrical energy, sure, like the energy that we use to turn these lights on here. That's electricity, all right?
What about food?
And food is a form of chemical energy. There are carbohydrates and lipids in food, so that's chemical energy. Now, what can that chemical energy in the food we eat, how can our body transform that into another kind of energy? What kind of energy can it be transformed into? Let me see. I'm thinking. Scratching my head. What am I doing? I'm using chemical energy, and I'm converting it into mechanical energy. Right, so that's what muscles do. So that energy isn't being lost, it's just being transformed into something else. And again, that isn't lost, that mechanical energy isn't lost, because it gets converted into heat in my muscle. And then that heat moves from my muscle into the atmosphere. All right, so there is that energy flow. Another kind of energy is light. Light is energy. And you know that light has different colors associated with it. Right, like the visible light spectrum, red, orange, yellow, blue, violet, indigo, violet. So the different colors of light means that light has different energies depending on what the color is.
So that would be like solar energy?
So solar energy is light energy. Yeah. Light is energy. Okay, so we looked at mechanical energy, chemical energy, light energy, and energy can be interconverted. So, for instance, in a power plant, it might use coal, for instance. There's chemical energy in coal that's used to turn a turbine, which is mechanical energy, and that turbine then creates electricity, and that electricity is another kind of energy. All right? So, as a matter of fact, we do a similar kind of thing, because I said that our bodies are very electrical in nature. Our bodies use chemical energy to produce electricity, like to run the sodium-potassium ATP pump. All right, so that's the first law of thermodynamics. And as a matter of fact, let's just talk about light energy again. Where in your body, what part of your body uses light as an energy? Yeah, your eyes, right? Your eyes convert light energy into chemical energy, okay? And that chemical energy then is perceived by your brain, which then you get the impression of light. Okay, the second law states that energy transformation increase entropy. And entropy is the degree of disorganization in the system. And whenever there is a process, after the process, it can be spontaneous only if the organization state of that energy is more disorganized after the reaction. So that's what the second law of thermodynamics states. And so our bodies are highly organized. We use energy to organize our bodies, but that means that there is a price for that organization, because our systems are producing like negative entropy. But in the process of organizing our bodies and making it very organized, we actually excrete energy in a very disorganized form. And that form basically is heat. And so we radiate energy out of our bodies in a very disorganized manner, and that's heat. And that's entropy. That excess entropy that we excrete from our bodies is used to maintain ourselves in a very organized state. So only free energy, and that is energy in an organized state, can be used to do work. Right? Systems tend to go from states of high free energy to states of lower free energy. That's the normal flow of energy. So, the second law dictates that all living organisms require a continual input of energy. Okay? And I guess why is that? And that's because inside our bodies, it's a highly organized state. And it will automatically disorganize itself. In order to maintain that organized state, we need energy to flow through it. Plants obtain energy from sunlight, because we said light is just another form of energy. And plants absorb that energy. Does anybody have an idea of how a plant absorbs that energy? They have a pigment. That's right. They have a pigment, and it's a most of them have a green pigment. It absorbs that energy. And a plant, oh, it's interesting. Okay. A plant can, with the use of chlorophyll, okay, it can organize carbon dioxide. It can absorb carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and join carbon dioxide together along with some water right here and produce a glucose molecule. So glucose is much more organized than these six carbon dioxide molecules. So this is negative entropy. In order to do that, the plant needs energy from the sun. So glucose has more energy, more free energy in it compared to these six carbon dioxides. Right, and animals then, we don't have chlorophyll. Too bad we don't have chlorophyll. Maybe one of these days we could get like a chlorophyll tattoo or something, because they're transplanting different pigments into different animals all the time. Like you've heard of those animals that they're taking bioluminescence from ocean organisms and transplanting them into fish, for instance, and then become translucent at night. They kind of glow at night. So that would be kind of nice, like to get some glowing earrings or something. That's just a cell that you transplant into yourself. All that's going to happen one of these days. Okay. okay, so what animals do then is that we don't consume carbon dioxide in water because there's no free energy in it. We consume what? Glucose, which has free energy. So there's a lot of energy in glucose. And the energy in glucose is used to combat disorganization, the tendency of our bodies to disorganize themselves, right? And also to power our bodies. So for instance, when an animal dies, right, they stop consuming glucose, they lose that ability to maintain that organization, and then what happens? Everything becomes very disorganized, right? We decompose, our cells degrade, okay, because we no longer can use that energy source. Okay, so there are basically two kinds of chemical reactions. There are endergonic reactions and exergonic reactions. An endergonic reaction requires input of energy to proceed. And just think of my car again, on a hill, right? My car going up the hill, right? Does that require energy? Yeah, that would be maybe an example of an endergonic reaction. But my car rolling down the hill, that's an example of an exergonic reaction. That's going to release energy. Okay. But in an endergonic reaction, the products contain more free energy than the reactants. So, let's write this on the board. Endergonic. Endergonic. We have reactants going to products. And where would we put energy? Where would we put energy? As an entity all by itself. For endergonic, we have to put it over here. We have energy. Energy plus reactants goes to products. And notice I didn't put energy on this side of the equation. Where did this energy go? Into the reactants. So the energy, I mean into the products. So energy is in these products now. Okay. So this reaction, reactants going to products, if it's endergonic, can't happen by itself unless you have what to make it go? Energy. Okay? All right, let's think about exergonic reactions. So that's endergonic, exergonic. What do we got? We've got reactants going to products, Okay, and where do we put energy here? On the left-hand side or right-hand side? On the right-hand side, right? Plus energy. And where did this energy come from? It came from the reactants over here in terms of chemical bonds within those reactants. And during this process, this chemical reaction, it is released. So that's an exergonic reaction. What's the delta G for this first case? Delta G for an endergonic reaction is positive. And the delta G for this exergonic reaction is negative. Okay? That means it releases energy right here. All right, so we said that plants use the sun, the sunlight. Oh, maybe I could go back one. Yeah. Plants use light energy, right? So here's light energy plus reactants, right? That's CO2 and water. And with using chlorophyll, it produces, what's the product? Glucose. Glucose right there is glucose plus oxygens. And what's in glucose? The energy that came from the sun. Okay, so plants have the ability to take the energy from the sun and put it into products, namely what? Glucose. And then we come along and eat glucose, which becomes a reactant. And what does glucose have in it?
Sugar.
Yeah, it's sugar. Okay, but it has the energy that the plant put in it, right? So our bodies then convert it into products, and that release of energy our body uses to move around or to maintain chemical gradients or electrical charges and all that kind of stuff, okay, via these endergonic and exergonic reactions. All right, so here we have a glucose. This is a plot of the free energy versus sort of like a time axis down over here. And we can break glucose all the way down via combustion to what the initial substrates for what photosynthesis was. What were the initial substrates for photosynthesis? It was carbon dioxide, right? So we can burn glucose all the way down, and maybe you've done this at home. Like what kind of dessert has burned glucose on it? Like I think creme brulee, right, has a little so when you caramelize a sugar, you're almost kind of burning it, okay? And if you really burn it, then it turns into carbon and even carbon dioxide and water. So here we can take glucose and we can burn it, right? And when you burn it, it releases energy, okay? Now, our body doesn't burn it with a flame because we would be, we would ourselves burn up. So our body converts glucose through a number of different steps. What did we call a number of different enzymatically catalyzed reactions that come right after each other? That was like on one of the two previous slides, something like that. That was a metabolic pathway. And so through a multi-step metabolic pathway, our bodies have figured out how to take a little bit of energy at each one of those steps, okay? And then this energy right here can be used to drive, right, an endergonic reaction, a reaction that requires energy. Let's look at this reaction. How about ADP plus inorganic phosphate going to ATP? What's the delta G of that reaction? Yeah, that's positive because it is endergonic. All right, it's an endergonic reaction. And how do we get endergonic reactions to work? They don't happen just all by themselves. What do we got to put into this? We got to put energy into it. All right. Okay, so we can get this endergonic reaction to work in our bodies if there is an energy source to do that. And where do we get that energy source from? From the combustion of glucose. We don't call it combustion in our bodies. We call it respiration. Okay? But our bodies need oxygen, right? So it's just a very carefully controlled combustion respiration in our bodies. So our bodies can make ATP because it can take energy from the breakdown of glucose. And what do we call that, the breakdown of glucose? Converting glucose into CO2. Is that anabolism or catabolism? Catabolism is taking a big molecule, breaking it down into small ones, and it releases energy. Okay? And then this reaction right here, is this catabolism or anabolism? This is anabolism. It's going the opposite way. We take small molecules, make a bigger one. But when we do that, what do we need? Energy, right? So it all relates to each other. Okay. CO2 and water. CO2 and water. Okay. And then I guess you could consider energy a substrate. You need energy to put CO2 together to make a carbon out of it. All right, so this reaction of making ATP can't happen by itself. It needs energy. And what kind of reaction does energy come from? What kind of reactions release energy? Exergonic reactions. So in order for your body to make ATP using this endergonic reaction, it has to be coupled with an exergonic reaction to make this go forward. Okay, so the next slide sort of describes that. Here we see two wheels. We see an exergonic reaction and an endergonic reaction. The endergonic reaction in this particular case is what? Taking ADP and inorganic phosphate and making ATP out of it. So this is sort of like a plot of free energy. All right, the higher you are up on this vertical scale, the more energy are in the molecules. So this reaction right here, the reactants have less energy than the products. So this would be like ADP and inorganic phosphate, and this product here would be ATP. This wheel can't turn all by itself because it's endergonic. It needs what in order to turn? Energy of some kind. And it could get energy from another metabolic pathway if they're coupled. So here's another metabolic pathway that's converting reactants into products, but this is an exergonic reaction. And exergonic reactions release what? Not just products, but energy as well. That energy can be used to drive, right, in a little graphical sense right here, this endergonic reaction. As long as there is more energy being released by the endergonic reaction compared to what's being consumed by the endergonic reaction, right, then these two processes can work together. Okay. So here is a nice molecule of ATP, and you can see that this is a nice ribose sugar right here. It's a 5-carbon sugar. And here is an adenine molecule. And on this carbon right here, we have 3 inorganic phosphates. And the bonds between the last 2 terminal phosphates on this molecule that we see by this little tilde right here, or squiggle, those are high energy bonds. Those are higher energy than typically what we see, what we see in a typical covalent bond. So what would we call this molecule if it only had 2 phosphates and not 3? If it only had 2, that would be adenosine diphosphate, and you see it on the blackboard right here. What happens if there was only 1 phosphate? What would we call it? Adenosine monophosphate. And if you have adenosine monophosphates, so these are now gone, do you see any high energy bonds? No. So adenosine monophosphate doesn't have any high energy bonds, but ADP has one. But the one that's most readily available is this third one right here in ATP. Okay, so adenosine diphosphate plus inorganic phosphate, okay, can be used to make ATP, as long as what else do you have up over here? That's what I have on the board. Because what kind of reaction is that? That's an endergonic reaction, and you need some kind of energy in order to make ATP. Okay. Most of the reactions that are used to make ATP in our body are what we call oxidation reduction reactions. And so let's just define what an oxidation reduction reaction is. Right? If a molecule gains electrons, we say it is reduced. Do you know what an electron is? Where do you find an electron? Valence, right, in shells around an atom someplace. They're not in the nucleus, but those are just things circling around the nucleus. And if a molecule gains some of those electrons, we say it is reduced. And if a molecule loses electrons, we say it is oxidized. All right, so from this, you could probably realize that if a molecule gains electrons, But it's getting it from another molecule, right? So if there is one molecule that is reduced, there has to be another that is what? That is oxidized. So these reactions always go together, so we call them oxidation-reduction reactions. So reduction just can't happen by itself. When one molecule is reduced, that means that another one has to be oxidized. Okay, a reducing agent donates electrons. An oxidizing agent, on the other hand, accepts electrons. And let me tell you where these terms come from. And that's because when we have a molecule of oxygen that we breathe in our bodies, O2, that molecule right there loves to accept electrons. So electrons like to flow into oxygen. Oxygen is very reactive. Okay, so what kind of agent is oxygen? What kind of agent is oxygen? It likes to accept electrons. So oxygen is what? An oxidizing agent. And that's where that term came from. All right? But if oxygen is accepting electrons, okay, it is really being what? It's being reduced, and that means something else is becoming oxidized because it's losing electrons. And that's where we get that terminology oxidation and reduction from. Okay. So how can you remember? You might have to take your time on the test to remember this kind of stuff and work through it. There are a couple little sayings that hopefully you can work all the little problems out with in your mind, and that is Leo Gr. Let me see if I have it right. Lose electrons, oxidation. Gain electrons, reduction. All right, so if you can't remember that slide, here's a little saying that you can use. There's another one, too, I think you learn in chemistry that's called oil rig. And this one, let's see if I can remember this. Who knows this one? That's probably what? Oxidize. Oxidize is losing. Reduction is gaining. I don't know if the I is or not, but it's close. That works for me. Okay. Okay, so reduction and oxidation are always coupled reactions. And this next statement, just cross off your notes about hydrogen ions. Okay. I always want you to focus on electrons. You're going to see that this is true, but I want you to focus on electrons in this class right here. All right, and what's a coenzyme again? What's a coenzyme? Is that a tiny molecule or is it a big organic molecule? Big organic molecule, right? And a coenzyme is a big organic molecule that takes something, takes a little chemical and transfers it to another step in the metabolic pathway or to another metabolic pathway someplace. So it's a carrier molecule for something. It's carrying something around the cell. All right, so there are coenzymes, little carrier molecules that play important roles as, and put electron carriers right here. They carry electrons around inside the cell. And as a matter of fact, don't just say electrons, put high energy electrons, energies that have energy with them. So if these electrons have energy, what do they have the ability to do?
A lot of energy.
They have a lot of energy. What do they have the ability to do? If you have a lot of energy, what do you have the ability to do? A lot of work, right? So these electrons, since they are high energy, they have the ability to do work. And they're carried around in the cell by NAD and FAD. These are names of chemicals. And you won't have to spell these out, but I know you're going to ask me what they are. So NAD is nicotine amide dinucleotide. You know what a nucleotide is. So this is like two of them put together, dinucleotide, with a what? An adenine base. So you're kind of familiar with this one already. This one is flavine adenine dinucleotide. So it's a similar kind of molecule, just a little bit bigger. And what kinds of metabolites can NAD and FAD carry around? What can they carry around? Something that has high energy. Okay, but I asked you to cross that hydrogen off. Electrons, but in particular high energy electrons. Okay, they carry high energy electrons around. And as a matter of fact, these are also vitamins that you have. You have a hard time producing those in your body. Okay. So,
do we have to know like the numbers, how many they make or anything like that?
I'll show you right now. Okay, I'll show you right now. All right, so every place where you see NAD in your book, okay, what you should actually write in, especially on your slides right here, NAD is really an ion. It is really a plus. So NAD plus. NAD plus, plus two electrons, okay, and a hydrogen ion, that's where this hydrogen comes from, but kind of forget about it, produces NADH. So here I see two positives, one on NAD and one on this hydrogen ion right here, and two electrons. What are they, when you combine them all, what do you get? You just get something neutral, NADH. All right, so NADH has become what? Oxidized or reduced? It has gained two electrons. When a compound gains electrons, it is reduced. Okay? All right, so that is a reaction. So anytime you see NAD, put a plus on it. FAD plus two electrons plus two hydrogens produces FADH2. Okay, that's the reduced form of FAD. Okay, so what is NAD carrying around with it? What is NAD moving, carrying around inside the cell? High energy electrons. Here they are right here, two of them. What about FADH2? What is it carrying around inside the cell? Some high energy electrons. Here are two of them right here. And so what do we call something that's carrying a metabolite around inside the cell? That's a coenzyme. So here are some coenzymes right here. Okay. So I think the next slide. Ah, here we have some pictures of what NAD and FAD really look like. And I don't think I'm going to spend a whole lot of time on this slide right here, okay? But here you can see an adenine nucleotide, another adenine nucleotide that's a dinucleotide, right? Nicotinamide dinucleotide. In the oxidized state, there is a little positive charge right here, but it can accept, right, two electrons, and that will neutralize that positive, and there's a hydrogen that binds to it, so it becomes neutral. So those two electrons are carried by, what, NADH right here. So NADH is in the reduced state because it has accepted electrons. Here is FAD, what it looks like. And two electrons can associate themselves with these ring structures over here, plus two hydrogens. All right, but what I really want you to know is that these sites right here are carrying the high energy electrons. So FAD becomes reduced into FADH2. FADH2 is carrying high energy electrons. What can those high energy electrons do again? What can high energy electrons do? High energy is good for a lot of work. That's right. If it's just a little bit of energy, a little bit of work. But if it's a lot of energy, it can be used to produce a lot of work. All right, so that's it for this particular chapter. All right, so now let's move to this one might be your favorite chapter. Right here. All right, chapter 5. What do I want to do? Pointer options, arrow options, visible. All right, so we're going to talk about some metabolic reactions like glycolysis, aerobic respiration, and we're probably not going to spend a lot of time on fat and protein metabolism, but we're going to spend a lot of time on these two right here. Okay, so metabolism. What is metabolism? This is a pretty good definition. All right, metabolism is just the sum of all chemical reactions in your body, the sum of all chemical reactions. All right, and this statement right here just says it's the sum of all reactions involved in energy transformations. I guess that's sort of true, but I would just rather say all chemical reactions added up in your body are metabolism. And furthermore, we can break metabolism down into two categories, catabolism versus anabolism. And catabolism, what, breaks down molecules and releases energy. What kind is that? Is that endergonic or exergonic? That's exergonic. Delta G is negative. Right? The primary source of energy for making ATP, right? So catabolic reactions, right, have a tendency to make ATP because that released energy can be used to drive an endergonic reaction, namely ADP plus inorganic phosphate. Anabolism makes larger molecules from small ones that requires energy. So these reactions are coupled to each other, so energy can be exchanged. All right, and anabolic reactions are the source of the body's large energy storage compounds. Now this slide right here is real important. We're going to modify this slide a little bit. I'm sure this is an exam figure we have right here. Okay, and we see some structures. Here I see a blood vessel, and we have glucose flowing in this blood vessel. This glucose can, and so the glucose is just dissolved in the plasma, that's the liquid part of blood. And this glucose can come from two sources. And as a matter of fact, before I start talking about this, do you think it's important to regulate and monitor blood glucose levels? Absolutely. If somebody loses that ability automatically, that's a pathological condition. What do we call that? Disease state. And that's diabetes mellitus, right? So it's actually a very serious kind of disease to have. All right, so blood glucose can come from two sources. It can come from the food that we eat via the digestive tract. And so when we're in a fed state, when we have glucose in our intestines, it will leave our intestines and be absorbed by the circulatory system. So that's one way that we can make glucose. But we're not always in a fed state, unfortunately, because sometimes we're in a fasted state. When are we fasting? Probably the most. Like, for instance, when we wake up first thing in the morning, right? We wake up after not eating all night long. We're definitely in a fasted state. There's no glucose in our digestive tract. But yet, if we're normal, our blood glucose level will be the same as when we were in the fed state, because as blood glucose levels decrease, right, the liver might be aware of that, and it will help convert glycogen into glucose, and then the liver will secrete glucose in the blood until it reaches the set point, in which case then the liver will stop secreting glucose into the blood. All right, so remember, what is the set point? That's just the normal value for what the glucose concentration should be in the blood. And we're going to look at that process. So blood glucose can be regulated by what we eat and also by our liver automatically. And there are two hormones that work on the liver to tell it what to do. And you're familiar with one of them. That's insulin. And the other is glucagon. We're going to look at those later on in the class. All right, so now we have glucose in the blood. And what this line right here represents is a cell. So here's the plasma membrane. So glucose goes inside the cell. And it's just floating around inside the cytoplasm. And it can be, how many carbons are in glucose? Six. There are six carbons in glucose. So it's a nice symmetrical molecule. Glucose can be chopped in half, right smack in the middle. You could take a scissors and chop it right smack in the middle and convert glucose into two pyruvic acids. So if we split glucose in half, how many carbons are in pyruvic acid? There are three, right? So glucose has six, we cut it in half, all right, we get two identical pyruvic acids, and pyruvic acid is exactly the same thing as pyruvate. All right, so pyruvate, you're going to see these interchangeably, is exactly equal to pyruvic acid. Exactly the same compounds. All right, so that process where we take glucose and split it in half is what we call glycolysis. When you lyse something, what do? You build something up or break something down? You break it down. Like when you lyse a cell, you blow it up. All right, so this is the breaking down of glucose. And furthermore, is this anabolic or catabolic? Glucose going to pyruvate. It's catabolic, and does it release energy or require energy? It releases energy. So here is an exothermic reaction. And what can your body do with an exothermic reaction or an exergonic reaction? Exergonic reactions release energy. That energy can be used to drive an endergonic reaction. And I erased a real important endergonic reaction. What was that one? ADP plus PI going to ATP. Right? That's a nice endergonic reaction. In order for that to go, it needs energy. Where does it get it from? An exergonic reaction, and show me an exergonic reaction over there. The first one is glycolysis. That's an exergonic reaction. So on your slides, maybe right about here, put a number one. Okay, I see some things highlighted, but glycolysis put number one. That's going to be the first metabolic pathway we're going to be interested in. All right. Okay, now the fate of pyruvic acid has, there are actually two fates for pyruvic acid. This right here, all of this light color, what is that, beige or something? Right here? That just means cytosol. That just means fluid inside the cell. Pyruvate can stay inside the cytosol, or it can go into the mitochondria. Familiar with a mitochondria, what it looks like and all that kind of stuff? Okay. Well, if pyruvate can enter the mitochondria, there has to be oxygen inside the cell. But if there is no oxygen inside the cell, pyruvate can't enter the mitochondria, and it stays in the cytoplasm. So pyruvate then enters what we call an anaerobic respiration pathway. Anaerobic means what? Without oxygen in the cytoplasm. And pyruvic acid gets converted into lactic acid under anaerobic conditions, when the cell does not have oxygen. Because if there was oxygen, what would happen to that pyruvic acid? It would enter the mitochondria. And pyruvic acid is still a pretty large molecule. It can be broken down further, and when it's broken down further, what is it going to release? Even more energy that can be used to make ATP. So our body doesn't really want to lose this. All right, so the first reaction is glycolysis. But under aerobic conditions, pyruvate enters the mitochondria. So we see into the mitochondria. It can enter another metabolic pathway that we call the Krebs cycle. All right, the Krebs cycle is going to break pyruvate down into CO2, completely into CO2. So that's going from a big molecule to small ones. That's going to release a lot of energy, which your body can harness to make ATP. Right, so the Krebs cycle is a series of exergonic reactions, right? But that only happens when the cell has oxygen. So this is part of aerobic respiration. So Krebs cycle, I want you to put a number two by.
What?
By the Krebs cycle. Maybe right here or over here. That's number two. Right, and then intermediates from the Krebs cycle are transferred to electron transport. That's a third. So put a number three up over here. That's a third metabolic pathway.
Electron
transport. Okay. So these are compounds. These are chemicals in the membranes of the mitochondria that transmit electrons from one molecule to another. So electrons flow from one molecule to another. So there's a series of oxidation reduction reactions happening between neighboring molecules in the membrane. And as a result, right, it's going to break down that pyruvic acid completely to carbon dioxide and water. And these are exergonic reactions, and these are the reactions that can make ATP as well. So how do you think these, how do the electrons get into this electron transport metabolic pathway? What kind of molecule can transfer electrons around inside the cell, especially high energy electrons? Coenzymes? Which coenzymes? Yeah, like NADH and FADH2. So these are the coenzymes that carry electrons to electron transport chain. Okay. All right, so let's look at some particulars. So I think you should probably refer to this slide a lot during the lecture. Right, and just see where the particular processes fit into this overall scheme right here. So you see two different kinds of metabolism, anaerobic respiration and aerobic respiration. A typical question would be, where does anaerobic respiration take place? In the cytoplasm. Where does aerobic respiration take place? Mitochondria. What molecule is not necessary for anaerobic respiration? Oxygen is not necessary. What molecule is necessary for aerobic respiration? Oxygen is necessary. Okay? All right, what is the end product of anaerobic respiration? Lactic acid. What's the end product of aerobic respiration that you see on this slide anyway? It is CO2 and water. And that's where we started with, right way back with plants. Okay. All right, so let's talk about glycolysis a little bit. So generally speaking, what's glycolysis again? What are we starting with and what are we doing to it? We're starting with glucose and we're snipping it in half. Right, that's glycolysis, the lysis of glucose. All right, so here is a synopsis for the reaction. All right, so it's a metabolic pathway by which glucose is converted into two pyruvates. And remember, there are three carbons in pyruvate. Does not require oxygen. And here is the overall net reaction. We have glucose plus 2 NAD. And what should we put up over here? Plus, NAD pluses, plus 2 ADPs, plus 2 inorganic phosphates goes to those two pyruvates, right? Because there are 6 carbons in glucose. There's only 3 in pyruvate, so we need to multiply by 2 to get the 6 carbons. Right? NAD becomes reduced, so it gets converted into NADH. And since this is an exergonic reaction so far, that excess energy can be used to put 2 ADPs together with inorganic phosphate and produce 2 ATPs. Now, is that a good thing to produce ATP in your body? Yeah, absolutely. Okay. All right. So glycolysis can make 2 ATPs when it breaks glucose down into 2 pyruvates. And let's not forget about these NADHs, because what is this NADH carrying around with it? The high energy electrons, and those high energy electrons have the ability to do work. All right, so glycolysis is the exergonic reaction, and it can be used, that excess energy that's being released can be used to make ATP, that endergonic reaction, as well as these 2 NADHs. All right, but to start the process off, it's going to take some energy to get it started, namely 2 ATPs. So here is a nice plot of the free energy, or you could consider this the Gibbs free energy or the delta G for various reactions versus the process through the metabolic reaction. When glucose enters the cell, it has to be phosphorylated. That requires an ATP. So your cell is losing ATP. And when it does that, it traps glucose inside the cell. Because can you remember what an inorganic phosphate really looks like? It's what? It's a big molecule. And it's charged. Can a big charged molecule like this get through the plasma membrane? Nope, because it's hydrophilic, can't get through the hydrophobic part of the membrane. So when glucose is phosphorylated, it's trapped inside the cell, but it also then acquires some of that energy from ATP.
Wow, shit. Back on the pyruvate, you said there was 3 carbons or 6 carbons?
Glucose is 6. You cut it in half, and then it goes to 3.
So it'd be 3 of the pyruvate.
Pyruvate is 3.
The world of 6, that goes 2.
Yeah, because here is glucose, 6 carbons. We split it right here, and then we get this 3 carbon. And then we get this 3 carbon right here. That's a pyruvate, and that's a glucose. So we break that bond. What's in this bond right here? There's energy in that bond that's going to be released. Right, so this is a nice catabolic reaction. Catabolic reactions release energy because there's energy in that bond. It's exogonic. Okay. So, but notice that glucose has to be phosphorylated twice. That consumes 2 ATP. Right, but now glucose, or the glucose that's been modified by this phosphorylation, now has a lot of energy, and it can start to participate in the second half of glycolysis, the part that starts to split it up. So we see a big energy drop. That big drop in energy can be used to reduce NAD into NADH. That happens twice. Here's another big energy drop. That can be used, and it's coupled to another endergonic reaction, what, ADP plus 2 inorganic phosphate, making 2 ATP. So at this step right here, when we get to 3, what's the overall energy balance now? We lost 2 ATP in the beginning, right? But now over here, we gained 2 ATP, right? It looks like we've already gained back all the energy that we lost to start glycolysis. Except don't forget, we got some of this energy stored in NADH, right? So we've paid back these 2 ATP that were spent to get glycolysis working. And then this last step over here, look, there is another big drop in free energy that can be used to make 2 more ATP. So when we go from glucose to pyruvic acid, the amount of ATP that we make is really what? 2, right? That's the net amount because it takes 2 to get it going, and we get 4. So 4 minus 2, we end up with 2 ATP. So glycolysis, how many ATPs can glycolysis make for every glucose? Just 2, right? All right, so that's actually a very small amount. It's sort of helpful in some tissues, but not very helpful, for instance, in the brain or the heart, which are just energy hogs. They need a lot more than 2 ATP. So in those tissues, and in other healthy tissues that have oxygen, this pyruvic acid is further metabolized to do what? Make even more ATP. And even convert the energy in these high-energy electrons to make ATP. So what's the organelle that can use NADH and this pyruvic acid to make even more ATP than what we see with glycolysis right here? We can go back to that first slide that you put those numbers on. Where does pyruvate go into? Into the mitochondria. Goes into the mitochondria where pyruvic acid is even broken down further. All right, so here is pretty much the complete pathway. I think in your textbook it gives you the names of these enzymes at these reaction steps right here. And I'm always wondering if I should make this an exam figure or not. You think maybe not? Maybe next semester or something? Okay. Well, you got to at least get a good feel for what this metabolic pathway is. Glucose going to 2-pyruvate or 2-pyruvic acid. We call that what? Glycolysis, because what? You're splitting glucose down. And what happens? You see that it first takes 2 ATP away from a cell, but then it generates 4, so the net gain is 2 ATP, and in the process, glucose is split in half. Can you see C3 down over here? I can't really make this slide any bigger. All right, so glycolysis is just the splitting of glucose into 2-pyruvate. And that's an exergonic reaction, right? The splitting of molecules that releases energy, and that release of energy can be used by the cell to make ATP. That's glycolysis. Okay. Well, let's talk about the lactic acid pathway. And let's see, where's that lactic acid pathway? The lactic acid pathway, all right, is this one here. Pyruvate going to lactic acid. Under what conditions does pyruvate go to lactic acid? Or how does pyruvic acid go to lactic acid? Under what conditions? Without oxygen, anaerobic conditions. Now, why does it come out over here? Well, under anaerobic conditions, pyruvic acid cannot enter the mitochondria. So it builds up inside the cell, in the cytoplasm. According to Le Chatelier's principle, if something builds up in the cytoplasm like pyruvic acid, what is the effect of that on glycolysis? What's the effect of a buildup of pyruvic acid on glycolysis? Because pyruvic acid can't leave the cell, can't get inside the mitochondria, it's going to build up and build up and build up. What's going to happen? According to Le Chatelier's principle, if there is a chemical that builds up on one side of the equation, it's going to force it to go in the reverse direction. Okay, it's going to go in the opposite direction. So pyruvic acid is going to have a tendency to go back up to glucose. But when that happens, what happens to the ATP production of the cell? It stops, right? Because this pathway glycolysis has to work in the forward direction to make ATP. And when a cell runs out of ATP, what happens? It's dead, right? So if a cell builds pyruvic acid up, it dies because it can't make ATP. So what's a way to protect this cell, right, to prevent the law of mass action or Le Chatelier's principle from taking effect? We get rid of pyruvic acid. And what's going to happen? glycolysis is going to still run in the forward direction to replace that pyruvic acid that gets built, that is going away, disappearing. So how does your body get rid of pyruvic acid? It converts it into lactic acid, and lactic acid then leaves the cell. It goes into the circulatory system. So it doesn't build up inside the cells like muscle cells when they're exercising. It leaves, goes into the blood. That's why the Chatelier's principle is so important to know. Okay, so let's go back. So this is the reaction that we're going to be looking at. And I passed it. Right here. Here is pyruvic acid being converted to lactic acid. It's converted by an enzyme called lactate dehydrogenase. All right, and it doesn't lose any carbons. All right, but pyruvic acid is going to be reduced, because it's going to gain some electrons from NADH. The electrons from NADH are used to reduce pyruvate into lactic acid, and lactic acid then leaves the cell. So this happens in the absence of oxygen. And this kind of chemical reaction in the absence of oxygen we call anaerobic respiration or fermentation. A fermentation reaction happens without oxygen. In lab, you're going to see another fermentation reaction, which after you have this, the next lab, I'll maybe talk about, because it's kind of fun to talk about another fermentation reaction. You already did that one already? Yeah, the one with the yeast. Okay? Okay. So here's a fermentation reaction that, oh, I don't have a lot of time, but it's so fun to talk about. Okay. Pyruvic acid being converted into lactic acid, and your body uses up NADH. I'm going to finish my thought and go back to the other fun reaction. All right, so what else is happening? The Chatelier's principle is working because you're getting rid of pyruvic acid so glycolysis can proceed. But what else does glycolysis need in order to go in the forward direction? It needs a cofactor, namely what? NAD, right? But as glycolysis proceeds in the forward direction, NAD gets used up. It gets converted into NADH. And if there's no NAD, glycolysis can't proceed in the forward directions. But there is a reaction that can regenerate this NAD that's being used up by glycolysis. What's the reaction that can be used to regenerate the NAD? We see it right here. That is what? Anaerobic respiration or fermentation also regenerates the NAD plus so that glycolysis can operate. And when glycolysis is operating, what's the good thing about that? It is making what? ATP, right? So the anaerobic pathway is important for a couple of reasons. Number one, it reduces the levels of pyruvic acid inside the cell, but it also regenerates an important cofactor that's necessary for glycolysis, and that's NAD+. Okay. All right, so that's what humans do. Let me see if I can remember this. I guess I'm going to have to erase these reactions right here. All right, you were looking at a yeast cell that could take pyruvate, all right, and chop off a carbon, produce a carbon dioxide plus another molecule. So how many carbons are in pyruvate here? No. 1, 2, 3.
Oh.
Okay, there's 3 carbons in pyruvate. All right, so here's one of them right here. So what's left over? How many carbon atoms? 2, right, because of the conservation of mass. And this is that carbon atom that's left over. And what is this compound called? This is an OH group, hydroxyl group. This is an alcohol. And a 2-carbon alcohol is what we call what? Ethanol. What's ethanol? That is adult beverage, right? You drink it, and what happens when you drink it? Does it give you a lot of energy? There is some energy associated with it, but mostly what? You become intoxicated. Why do you become intoxicated? Because this compound is toxic, right? It's toxic to your brain, your central nervous system. So humans don't have this metabolic pathway because what does it produce? A toxic compound. So our bodies can't get away with this like yeast, but a yeast doesn't have a brain, so they don't really care, right? They can produce ethanol, And another byproduct is CO2. We use this industrially, not just to make ethanol for our consumption and other kinds of chemical reactions in the laboratory, but we use it to produce CO2, which is a gas, right? That's carbonation in drinks. Like, what's a drink? What's your favorite drink that's carbonated? I mean, like, not Moet and Chandon and champagne? Okay, that is carbon dioxide, right? Sparkling wines have ethanol in them because of this fermentation process, but there's also CO2. Other wines, all right, that have alcohol in them, they just let the CO2 escape into the air. It's not kept in the bottle, so it's not a sparkling kind of wine. All right, so this is what we call alcohol fermentation. All right, so that's a different enzyme than lactate dehydrogenase. This is alcohol dehydrogenase. Our bodies don't make that enzyme. That's too bad. Maybe we could trick ourselves how to do that. But it's a good thing because, for instance, if we were to hold our breath, what would happen if we had this enzyme right here? We would get drunk, okay? Right, because this is what? An anaerobic pathway. This happens in the absence of oxygen. So if we cut off oxygen to our bodies, like holding our breath, if we had this enzyme, we would produce ethyl alcohol and then we'd become intoxicated. That's not a very good adaptation, right? We can't function when we are intoxicated. So that's a different kind of fermentation reaction, but both are starting with pyruvate. Yeah. I have no idea. Before you leave, I'll Google it. And you know, you can misspell something in Google and it will come back and say, well, did you really mean this? And we'll see how Google spells it. It's actually correct. Okay, at the end of lecture today, we'll do that. Okay, so this is anaerobic respiration. It maintains glycolysis, right, even under anaerobic conditions. Now, this lactic acid pathway only produces, what, 2 ATPs? Our red blood cells don't have mitochondria, doesn't have any organelles, doesn't even have a nucleus. And so the lactic acid pathway is really the only pathway that a red blood cell can generate ATP. But it doesn't need a lot of ATP. But other cells, like skeletal cells and heart muscle, okay, can produce some ATP in the absence of oxygen, right, and it might keep these tissues alive. But other tissues can't survive anaerobically because they require way too much ATP. So, for instance, under what conditions do our muscles produce lactic acid? Under anaerobic conditions, how does a muscle become anaerobic? When you contract it, right, like this muscle right here that I'm contracting, this big biceps right here, when I contract it, it does what? It turns into a solid mass, right? It solidifies, and blood can't flow into it. If blood can't flow into that muscle, neither can oxygen get into the muscle. So when that muscle is contracted like that, what kind of metabolic pathway is operating, producing some ATP? Anaerobic respiration, right? Anaerobic respiration, and I relax it, right? That feels a lot better. And now aerobic respiration is taking back over again. Okay, so the buildup of lactic acid is actually painful, and you're probably aware of that. Have you ever had a cramp someplace? Okay, it's really painful. And that's just due to the buildup. Well, one of the reasons is the buildup of lactic acid inside the cell. Okay. Yeah, it's extremely painful. What might produce it? Well, damage to a skeletal muscle cell can cause it to contract involuntarily. It could be due to maybe a lack of potassium or that's probably it. Not calcium necessarily, but potassium. Yeah. Okay, so what did we look at so far? What was that first metabolic pathway? It was called glycolysis. Glycolysis is what I was kind of thinking about myself. Okay, so I'm going to write some of these terms on the board. Glycolysis. And what is glycolysis? What does it start with? Glucose going to... Oh, I got to erase that ethanol. It goes to what? Pyruvate. And under anaerobic conditions, that pyruvic acid goes to lactate. Okay, so that's glycolysis. Okay. Let's look at this slide right here, then I'll go back. There's a couple other terms. Actually, I'll write these on the board right now. Glycolysis, all right. Then there is gluconeogenesis. All right, so make sure that you can pronounce these different terms and that you can see these different terms. They're very similar, all right, but you got to know the difference between them. So if you can't see how they're spelled differently, then I don't know, you got to go see an ophthalmologist or something and get reading glasses because they're spelled very similarly. All right, gluconeogenesis. Then we got two more terms. We've got glycogenolysis. Glycogenolysis. All right, and so what is glycogenolysis? It is what? A lysis reaction. Is that similar to genesis or glycolysis? It's similar to glycolysis. All right, and then the last one is glycogenesis. All right, so here are four terms. And let's describe what these four different pathways are. These are metabolic pathways, and just like glycolysis that has many steps to them, these may have many steps as well. Okay, so here we have glucose in the blood. It's going to enter the cell, and when glucose enters a cell, it gets trapped inside the cell by what? By it being phosphorylated. Then it can't leave the cell. And it turns into glucose 6-phosphate. What kind of enzyme phosphorylates something? You should know the name of the general name of that enzyme. It's either a phosphatase or a kinase. Phosphatase or kinase. So an enzyme that phosphorylates something is a kinase. That's a kinase. So we would call this glucose 6-kinase. Okay? So that traps the glucose inside the cell. This glucose has a number of different fates. It can, through this process, be converted into fructose and then all the way down to pyruvate. So on this slide, maybe just put in pyruvate over here. So what is that process called of glucose being converted into pyruvate? As a matter of fact, how many pyruvate? Two pyruvate. What's that? So that's glycolysis, right? That's glycolysis. So glucose going to pyruvate, that's glycolysis, that's one. But it has other fates. Glucose can be used as a building block for glycogen. So what is glycogen again? It's like animal starch. It is just thousands of glucose molecules bound together. Okay. All right, so this pathway right here, number one, where glucose loses this phosphate, so this enzymatic reaction right here is catalyzed by a phosphatase, all right, but that incorporates glucose into glycogen. Now, number one has got a name, too, that I wrote on the board. Number one is what we call glycogenesis. Glycogenesis is making glycogen. See how similar these terms are? But you got to become familiar with these terms, right? Glycogenesis, genesis means what? Making glycogen. That's with a phosphatase enzyme. All right, and that glucose and glycogen can be used when you're in a fasted state to put glucose in the blood. So we can take glycogen and break it down into glucose. And we have to phosphorylate when that happens. So this would be a kinase. All right, a glucose 1-phosphate kinase. And the name of number two is what? The breaking down of glycogen. What's the breaking down of glycogen that I have on the board? That is glycogenolysis. So number two is glycogenolysis. Glycogenolysis is the reverse of glycogenesis. Well, you don't want to say that really fast. You certainly probably have to think about it, right, at this point in time. I mean, I still have to think about it before I open my mouth, right? And get it straight in my mind. So you might want to draw this figure out a couple times, but I'm sure it's an exam figure. All right, so just like glucose going into glycogen or glycogen going into glucose, these are reverse reactions. The same thing for glycolysis. There is a reverse glycolysis. The reverse glycolysis is what? Pyruvate being used to go back up to make glucose. putting two pyruvates back together to make glucose. And that is our fourth term right here. That is gluconeogenesis. It's making what? It's making new glucose. Neogenesis, new glucose. All right, so there are different enzymatic pathways, and you can see that arrow going back up. As a matter of fact, if you were to look at this previous diagram over here, let me see if I can get back pretty quickly to it. Yeah, right here. Ooh, is it in focus enough? People in the front of the room can see it. All right, where do you see gluconeogenesis on this diagram? Where do you see it on this diagram? How would you how would you tell me to look for it on this diagram? Okay, yeah, this is true. And how is that symbolized on this illustration right here? We see glucose being converted into pyruvic acid. That's symbolized by these solid arrows right here. But what else do you see? You see the broken arrows over here. So these broken arrows represent what kind of metabolic pathway? Gluconeogenesis. So on this diagram, you see both glycolysis going down to make pyruvic acid from glucose, and you see gluconeogenesis, which is what? Just the reverse of glycolysis. All right, but it's going to require different enzymes at some of these steps. Okay, because to go up at this step right here, guess what you need to do? You need to spend an ATP to get it to go back up. Because going down is the exothermic reaction, going up is endergonic. And to drive an exergonic reaction, you need energy to do that. You would get that from ATP.
So in other words, stopping would be exergonic?
Okay. Glycolysis is exergonic. Gluconeogenesis is endergonic. Yeah. Okay. And in order to run an endergonic reaction, you need some kind of other energy source. And in your body, that would be ATP. Right, so only under conditions where you have a lot of ATP to spend on something will your body undergo gluconeogenesis. But when your body is starving for ATP, you don't make more glucose, you do what? You break it down to make ATP. So the reaction can switch back and forth depending on your energy state.
So gluconeogenesis is
new glucose? New glucose, the making of new glucose. The making of new glucose, the opposite of glycolysis. Okay. All right, so.
I thought you said that was a glucogenesis. I'm talking about
the gluconeogenesis. Oh, yeah, let's go back. Gluconeogenesis, right, is the reverse of glycolysis, making glucose from pyruvate. Right, but there's also glycogenesis. Mm-hmm. Glyco is what? Glycogen, not glucose. Yeah, so glycogenesis is the making of glycogen from glucose. So over the weekend, you've got to look at that a couple of times. Well, once you see it, I think it won't be too bad. Okay. So here are some terms that you should be familiar with, what? Glycolysis, glycogenesis, glycogenolysis. Right, gluconeogenesis, make sure you know a definition of these things, but we kind of went over it already. Make sure you can just label them on this diagram right here, right? And the way that I learn this stuff, I like graphical methods. So if you want to draw this diagram out and label those four metabolic pathways, I think, you know, probably most people think the way that I do, that would be really handy for you to do that. Okay. Okay. So why, the last point before we go tonight is, why does your body store glucose in glycogen instead of just filling the cell up with glucose? Some cells maybe kind of do that, but for instance, if we have a cell and it's in a fed state and a lot of glucose is going in it, what is glucose? Is it a solvent molecule or solute? It's a solute, right? So the normal cell has what, 0.9%? NaCl, but what happens to the concentration of solute if you start to put millions of molecules of glucose in it? The solute concentration goes up. What about the water concentration? So water goes down when we start putting a bunch of glucose molecules in here. So water goes down, but water on the outside of the cell does what? stays the same. Right, so we see a decreased water concentration inside the cell, stays the same outside. So as we put more and more molecules of glucose together, what happens to water? It goes into the cell. And if we put a lot of glucose molecules in here, it's going to burst the cell. So a cell can't store glucose as an individual particle because it's going to burst. So what does the cell do? It takes these millions of particles and what? Connects them together and just makes one particle out of them. Just makes one big particle. And now the water concentration is the same inside and outside the cell, and the cell doesn't change its shape. So that's the reason for storing, that's one of the reasons for storing glucose in one big molecule instead of thousands or tens of thousands of separate molecules. Okay, so somebody should make a note that we're going to start here next time. Not right here, maybe the next slide. So probably over the weekend, look at the Cori cycle. And again, okay, make sure you can label, right, pyruvic acid going to glucose. That is what? Gluconeogenesis, right? And glucose going to glycogen. That is what? Glycogenesis. Glycogen going to glucose is glycogenolysis. And glucose going down to pyruvate. That is glycolysis, right? Okay. All right, and then we're going to talk about the rest of respiration next time. Okay. Yeah, our exam is going to be, what did I say? It's going to be a week from tonight. Okay. Week from tonight, which is October 2nd. Okay, I'll put the lectures online. All righty.